any problems in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Yemen, are all associated with Iran. So if you instill this premise in the public that, well, all the problems we have originate in Iran, it's easy to come to the conclusion, well, the way to get rid of the cancer is go straight to Iran, take out the tumor, and all the other problems will be solved. I mean, it's an absurd argument.
That's Ervant Abrahamyan, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Ervant Abrahamyan on the U.S. and Iran, four decades of hostility. The danger of war between the U.S. and Iran is increasing. U.S. forces virtually surround that Middle Eastern country, and they are being ramped up. In classic gunboat diplomacy, a U.S. aircraft carrier battle group is positioned off the coast of Iran. Imagine if Iran had a naval armada off of New York or had troops in Canada. Why would Iran risk an armed confrontation with Washington? U.S. firepower would obliterate it. The Secretary of State demands that Iran, quote, behave like a normal nation, unquote. By that, does he mean like the U.S. with its bases everywhere and almost trillion-dollar military budget? Why did the U.S. abandon the Iran deal, which according to the U.N. was working? Instead of sending warships, missiles, and bombers to the Persian Gulf, Washington should send diplomats. We should have dialogue rather than hectoring and threatening war. Our guest today is Ervant Abrahamyan, Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Iranian and Middle Eastern History at the City University of New York. He's the author of Iran Between Two Revolutions, A History of Modern Iran, and The Coup, 1953, the CIA, and the Roots of Modern U.S.-Iranian Relations. I talked with him at the University of Denver on April 24th, 2019. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, David. Thank you.
40 years have passed since the revolution overthrowing the Shah and the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran. In broad strokes, where do you see Iran today?
Well, I think what you're seeing after 40 years, I mean, in some ways the regime has solidified, you can say. It's much, the expectation actually at the time of the revolution that this was a temporary phenomenon, it would collapse. It's been able to survive mainly through dramatic economic social reforms that from 1980 on really brought a lot of improvements in the standard of living, especially in the countryside. And that strengthened the regime very much. Now, of course, it's under the pressure of sanctions. There's rising expectations. You've had a now huge middle class built by the educational system. So the demands on the regime are much greater now than before because it's actually the society has developed a great deal. And on top of that, with the new sanctions, you find that obviously economic issues are going to become much more prominent in terms of people's discontent. You saw that last year with protests, especially in the provinces. So you're seeing a new phenomena which didn't exist before, of great deal of economic discontent against the regime. This, however, I don't think really means the pre-revolutionary conditions, because the regime still has a great deal of legitimacy because of the revolution, and it does have a great deal of social support, which the old regime never had. It has a great deal of support among those who've actually gained economically a great deal from the revolution. These are entrepreneurs, businessmen, who are tied to the bazaar community, and they're also very much tied to the clerical community. And then you have, of course, the creation of a new institutions, the Revolutionary Guards, the new army, because when the revolution occurred, Khomeini didn't trust, for good reason, the old army. So the old Shah's armed forces were not disbanded, but they were relegated to the margin. And he created out of nowhere a new army called the Revolutionary Guards. And these were mostly ideologically committed young people who had participated in the revolution, often as street kids, and helped bring about the regime. They became the core of the new army. And of course, that army played an important role in fighting the Iraqis when Saddam Hussein invaded Iran. So what you have now in Iran is a new institution that is fully committed to the regime. And this is not something that existed under the old Shah. The Shah had a huge army, but he really couldn't depend on it very much. He knew a lot of the army officers were not ideologically committed. So in that way, I think the Trump administration that thinks that if they put economic squeeze, this is going to unravel the system, are wrong. I think what will happen, it might even strengthen the diehard people in Iran against the more moderates who've been trying to negotiate with the West. And this is actually the dangerous situation, where if the diehards actually get the upper hand, they might actually want a confrontation with the administration. And the more moderates in Iran, Rouhani, the president, Zarif, the foreign minister, their strategy is to waiting out to Trump. They're hoping that Trump is a one-term president, that after him, there will be back to normal. So their strategy is to keep calm, keep on good relations with Europe, don't restart the nuclear program, keep on good terms with China, Russia, and weigh out the Trump administration. But if that doesn't work out, if there's a second Trump presidency, I think this administration would be out to actually get the Islamic Republic. They would want a confrontation. Then if you have two sides both wanting a confrontation, we would be heading to basically another Middle East war.
Now, you said in the eyes of many Iranians, the government has legitimacy, but two-thirds of the population, and this is a country of something like 80 million people, two-thirds of the population is under the age of 25. They have no memory of the revolution.
This thing of memory is, I think, often exaggerated. Memory is often what you get from your family, what oral history. And I think they know that this revolution was a very popular revolution. And it's, I mean, 40 years isn't that long. A lot of their parents participated in it. There's also, of course, there's been a great deal of ideological propaganda since then. So the new generation has grown up thinking very much of, as a generation of the revolution. Now, there is a difference. I think the difference isn't so much among generations. It's much more among class. So that people who've been educated, especially university, also tend to come from more upper-class families, tend to be more secular. They would be more alienated. They're the ones who want opening up, while children of especially villagers, working class, bazaaris, I wouldn't be that keen on saying that they're actually would be discontented with the regime.
Describe the structure of governance. You have the supreme leader, there's an elected president. It's somewhat contradictory.
It's a strange hybrid. It's actually, you won't find it anywhere. It's a hybrid of, on one side is Republican democracy, and the other is a theocracy. And this is a funny combination, and that's why the Constitution is so complex. The original Constitution was actually drafted in Paris before Khomeini went back to Iran, And it was modeled on Charles de Gaulle's Fifth Republic, French Republic. So it was a pure republican constitution. When they, in Tehran, the clerics got around to rewriting it, they imposed on that French constitution the concept of clerical rule. So under the old constitution, they had an umbrella where the chief cleric was supposed to be then the guide of the republic, and he was supposed to be then the leader. In the West, we call him the supreme leader. Actually, he's just called the leader in Iran. So it's often called a dictatorship, which is actually a misnomer, because there's a lot of electoral system in this very hybrid. Your president is elected, parliament is elected, and technically, actually, the supreme leader is elected. There's an assembly of religious experts who elect the supreme leader, but those experts are actually supposed to be elected, and they are elected. It's sort of a rich, controlled election, and very few people participate because they know it's not meaningful. But when it comes to parliamentary elections and council elections, there is a great deal of participation. People take it seriously. If there is any sign that there is really a rivalry between a conservative and a reformer, people participate. So in an ordinary, common Iranian election, you might get 70 to 80% of the electorate actually voting, which is quite something. I mean, in America, it'd be lucky if we get 55% of the electorate voting. So, you know, 70, 80% is not bad. And, you know, the leader in Iran could very well tell America that, you know, we'll negotiate with Trump once you get true democracy in America and you can increase your electoral participation up to maybe 70%, then we'll take you seriously.
Well, speaking of memories, talk about the 1953 coup, Operation Ajax, organized by the CIA with the participation of the British MI6 intelligence service that overthrew the government of Mohammad Mossadegh and brought the Shah back to the peacock throne.
Well, I think 53 for Iran is actually a landmark event. It's the big landmark event before 79. So it's like a guillotine that comes down in Iranian history and nothing can change, starts moving again until 79. So for most Iranians, 53 is the formative period in modern history. In the West, you find that there is no memory at all. It's not just that I don't expect the average American to know something, but you find that even leading Americans, diplomats who worked in Iran, really were not aware of 53. It was like Orwellian shredding of history. There was little mention of it, little memory of it, little talk of it. In fact, people were ignorant of 53, even top diplomats. So when 79 revolution came about and students took the hostages and invaded the American embassy, it was a real cultural clash. For Iranians, people knew what was the story about behind it. For Americans, this was sort of out of the blue. Why should these people be invading our embassy? We've been good friends with Iran all these years. Why are they so ingratious that they invade? So there was this lack of understanding over 53. I think it goes to the root of really the conflict between U.S. and Iran.
In terms of the Iranian context, and you've already used a couple of these terms like hardliners, reformers, and moderates, can you sort that out?
It's hard to answer that because it's not clear. It's not political parties necessarily where people have all the same view. But on the whole, what you can say, the hardliners are the people who are very stringent on the clerical leader having tight control and determining policy. while the reformers or moderates are much more in terms of professionals, diplomats, foreign ministry, knowing best how to deal with America, Europe, and so on. And that's on the political top level. But on other issues, you find intellectual, the dieharders take a very narrow interpretation of Shia Islam. They basically try to legitimize their understanding, their laws, on learning from traditions that are based on Shia Islam, while the reformers are much more open to outside ideas, especially the ideas of the Enlightenment, individual rights, open trials. So intellectually, you get this conflict between, you can put it simply into, some people call it fundamentalist Islam, I'd call it basically much more dogmatic Islam, versus people who are much more flexible. And their way of arguing is, yes, Islam is still our basic ideology, but in Islam you should always change the laws to adapt to modern situations. And the modern situations in Iran in the 21st century are not the same as they were in the 8th century Arabia or Middle East. So they're willing to much more adapt to modern concepts.
The country is 90% Shia. In terms of Iranian identity, what role does Shia Islam play?
Well, there's a strange mixture between Iranian nationalism and Shiism, because once Iran was occupied by the Arabs, Muslims, many people adopted Islam. But there was also this tension between Iranism and people who spoke Persian, and their culture was Persian, and the new religion. And out of this tension, you find that there is a much more of spreading of Shia ideologies, Shia thinking in Iran. So you can see this in the Shahnameh and Ferdowsi. I mean, Ferdowsi, writing in around 1000 AD, is a Muslim, but a lot of the stories he has are actually comes from Iranian history. And a lot of the martyrdom, the notion of martyrdom, Siavash and so on, that become very important in Shiism were already there in Iranian identity. So Shiism was a fit for Iranian way of separating themselves from the Arab world. And after 1500 with the Safavids, when they actually adopted Shiism as the official language.
Official religion.
At that point, you get that 90% of the population gradually converting. So a lot of former Sunnis then actually converted to Shiism. So I would say Shiism, although you can say theologically there are differences, the real difference is that in Iran it represents national identity.
Well, Iran is far and away the largest Shia country. Neighboring Iraq has a majority Shia population. Mm-hmm. Bahrain is also a Shia majority. But where does Iran see itself in terms of its place in the region?
Well, I don't think Shiism is there really the important issue here. The Islamic Republic, I think they weren't even aware that there were Shiis, for instance, in Syria or in Yemen. For them, it was much more a question of Iran and protecting Iran, defending Iran after the revolution. But once you had the crisis in other countries, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Those ethnic groups, like the Alawis, they would never consider themselves Shi, but because of political reasons, it was useful for them then to make an alliance with Iran. But their main concern of Assad, again, wasn't Shiism. Assad's main concern was survival of his regime. And his base were Alawis, and they were scared of the jihadists in Syria. So it was a natural alliance between Assad and the Alawis and Iran. But it's not really based on, I don't think, religion or theology. It's the same you can say with the Zaydis in Yemen. And the same also in Iraq. A true majority, large population of Arabs are Shi, but they never really saw themselves as Iranian type of Shias. They were always separate, the language is different. But because of American intervention, the invasion, a lot of then Iraqi politicians or Shi find it useful to be allied with Iran as their protector.
In your book, The Coup, you write, the U.S. and Iran have been locked in a deadly embrace. You compare the relationship to an iron cage. Well, it wasn't always that way. I went back a little bit into history, and Jimmy Carter went to Tehran in 1977, in fact, December 31st, New Year's Eve, and there was a reception and banquet for him. The Shah prepared everything lavishly. And Carter said at the time, he called Iran an island of stability in one of the most troubled areas in the world. He praised the Shah for his, quote, great leadership and noted, quote, the respect and admiration and love which your people give to you. Well, it wasn't long after that that there were strikes and huge demonstrations. And on January 16, 1979, just a little over a year after that dinner banquet, the Shah fled Iran and the Pahlavi monarchy ended.
Yes, that speech actually later, I think, haunted the Carter administration. When he made that speech, now we know that the American ambassador was there and the embassy officials were there. They looked at each other in horror because they already knew that there was trouble brewing in Iran. They weren't at the point of saying there's a revolution, but they really did not expect this speech. And the reason Carter made the speech was because the Shah at that time felt that he was not being given enough support by the United States. So it was a compensation for the demonstrations there had been in Washington by the Iranian students against the Shah when he visited. And there was always this complaint from the Shah that the Carter administration is not backing me. Instead, they're talking about human rights and liberalization. So to reassure the Shah of that this wasn't so, Carter came out with this very sort of flattering speech, which then made actually Carter administration very ridiculous because he was talking about stability when the regime was already very unstable.
Now, the aforementioned hostages were released the very afternoon of Reagan's inauguration, giving birth to a whole plethora of theories about what kind of secret deal was struck between Tehran and Washington.
Did you use the word collusion? There probably was no collusion in that. The two sides didn't sit down and draft a paper and say, you know, I'll be nice to you if you hold the hostage. I don't think there was that sort of agreement. But I think there was probably a silent, tacit idea both in Tehran that if we're going to undermine Carter, it's best to keep the hostages as long as possible and then release them when Reagan comes in. Again, this would never have been written down, but I'm sure it was a tacit understanding there. I don't know if later on the secret dealings that Reagan had with Iran and the sale of arms was really tight with that because that came later. But this made it possible for in Iran to think that, well, the Republican administration might be more basically pragmatic or more cynical about dealing with the revolutionary government.
The Iran-Contra scandal broke in 1986. It was characterized infamously by the National Security Advisor, Robert McFarlane, taking a cake to give to Ayatollah Khomeini.
Yes, they also sent a Saturday special to the president Rafsanjani too. I mean, it was a very cynical move because the whole time they had been pressuring the Europeans not to deal with Iran, sell arms to Iran. Meanwhile, this secret deal, and I think there was a lot of different layers of it. One simple explanation was that people in the White House wanted money to give to the Contras. The Congress had outlawed that. So one way of getting money was basically smuggling guns to the regime in Iran, then using the money to send to the Contras. So that was that side. Then there was an Israeli side that wanted to, again, have a rapprochement with Iran. They came into the scene and persuaded not Reagan himself, but people around him, that this was a way of building bridges. And then the way they rationalized it was that they were moderates in the regime, and they wanted to establish good relations with the moderates.
The war with Iraq in the 1980s, Iraq invades Iran in September of 1980, had devastating effects on Iran, hundreds of thousands of people killed, many more wounded. But then the U.S. actively joins on the Iraqi side in 1987-88. The Navy is attacking Iranian oil installations and the like. And then in 1988, the U.S. shoots down Iran Air Flight Number 655, resulting in the death of 290 passengers and crew. That essentially pushed Khomeini to sue for peace, sue for a negotiation with Iraq.
Yes, actually, the war was, another formative period, especially for the generation that rules Iran now. Because for them, when Saddam Hussein invaded, it was clear foreign invasion. By international law, the international community should have come to Iran's aid. And then he started using weapons of mass destruction, gas. And during that period, there was no any complaints from the West about it. It was silence. So the lesson the rulers in Iran learned is you can't depend on the West for security. Because even when illegal weapons are used like gas, the West doesn't get involved in it or doesn't protest. Here, actually, one should say that the U.S. was not involved in the poison gas. That came mostly from Europe. What the U.S. was complicit in it was it encouraged Arab states, the Gulf states, to pour money, billions of dollars, to Saddam Hussein so he could continue the war, because they came to the conclusion that Saddam Hussein had to survive. But the U.S. only came in at the very end. And by then, probably Iran would have had to sue for peace. The premise of Khomeini, when he continued the war, he could have ended the war in 1982, was he thought that if he continued the war, there would be an uprising of Shiites in Iraq, and that would overthrow Saddam Hussein. And that didn't happen. So the war just continued and continued with a stalemate, with no uprising in Iraq. and Iranian forces weren't strong enough to go into Baghdad, and the Iraqis weren't strong enough to defeat Iran. So you had basically a sort of stalemate like World War One that went on until basically it became clear to the Iranian elite that the only way is to sue for peace.
You're listening to Ervant Abrahamyan on the U.S. and Iran, four decades of hostility. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program and Ervant Abrahamyan's book, The Coup, 1953, The CIA and the Roots of Modern U.S.-Iranian Relations, by calling 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Washington Today says Iran is meddling in the Middle East. It's interfering in the internal affairs of the countries of the region. It's a rather interesting claim that they make, given that the U.S. has a string of bases and actually occupies countries in the region. But explain why this hype threat through the media is so effective in convincing many people that Iran is actually a great strategic danger to the United States and the so-called West.
I think there is a strong reservoir of anti-Iranian feelings in America because of the hostage crisis. So you already start with, you could say, that premise. You can tap into that hostility. But the strategy they're using now is very much the same strategy the neocons used with Saddam Hussein, arguing that Saddam Hussein is the root of all the problems. Now Islamic Republic is the root of the problems. So if you get rid of that source, other problems in the Middle East will be solved. So they're even tying Al-Qaeda, ISIS, to the Islamic Republic. Any problems in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Yemen, are all associated with Iran. Hamas, Hezbollah, they're all seen as proxies of Iran. So if you instill this premise in the public that, well, all the problems we have originate in Iran, it's easy to come to the conclusion, well, the way to get rid of the cancer is go straight to Iran, take out the tumor, and all the other problems will be solved. And it's interesting the speech Pompeo made, where he said, well, we're willing to negotiate with the Islamic Republic, but we have 12 conditions they have to meet. And some of those conditions were like somehow the problems in Syria, Yemen had to cease because Iran was causing it. Then U.S. could then sit down to negotiate with Iran. To paraphrase Clemenceau, you know, Clemenceau said the good Lord gave us only 10 commandments. Woodrow Wilson gives us 14. And Pompeo has now given Iran 12 commandments they have to observe. And then the commandments are basically, we have to solve the problem, or somehow the issues of Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan have to be solved. And then we could deal with the nuclear issue with Iran. I mean, it's an absurd argument.
Iran's military budget at the high end is $30 billion a year. That's simply dwarfed by the amount of money the U.S. spends on the military and with its archipelago of bases. Yet, again, tapping into that resentment and deep-rooted hostility, it plays out in people's imagination that indeed Iran is a great danger.
Actually, the budget is even smaller. According to the Swedish thing, it's more like $19 billion, which is peanuts compared to Saudi Arabia spends $90 billion. So Iran is not a military power. But the way they were trying to portray it in the media here through the administration is Iran is somehow trying to rebuild the old Iranian empire all the way from the Mediterranean to India. So it has a big military might, and is about to devour all these countries through this big, huge military. And the military is actually not really a military. The Revolutionary Guards are more like National Guard, American Guard, rather than, you know, professional hardened troops. They don't have any offensive capability. And so the substitute often is now that General Soleimani, who is in charge of the special corps, which is actually up, I think, 8,000 men. So he doesn't have a lot of tanks, planes, but he's supposed to have the term they use, diabolical powers. So if you have diabolical powers, you can have supernatural ability to threaten the United States. You don't have to have the planes or the submarines. Somehow you can conjure up from nothing ability to undermine U.S. power, which is, as you say, is ridiculous. If you compare the American military to Iran, it's a joke.
There seems to be a fixation on, in some parts of the government in Iran on Israel and the Palestinian question. Does Tehran see Palestine as a wedge to endear itself to the larger Arab Muslim population in the Middle East?
There are probably people who see it that way, that this is, again, because Iran is Shia, one way of basically appealing to outside was to be more militant about this Palestinian issue. But again, a lot of it is polemic rhetoric, because Iran has made sure it's never actually confronted Israel. So they talk about Palestinian rights and so on. They help support a Hezbollah, but Hezbollah's main concern is Lebanese politics. And Hezbollah has never really talked about liberation of Palestine. They're more talking about protection of Lebanon. And you find actually during the Khatami period, Khatami actually went on record saying that if the Palestinians were willing to settle with a two-state solution, Iran would be happy to accept that. So for them, it's that the idea that Iran is out to destroy Israel. You can say, well, you know, in parades they say that in rhetoric, but this, I would say, is much more rhetorical. And of course, Israel has often talked about destruction of the Islamic Republic, so it's tit for tat. But I think it plays very well in Israel for the Likud, because they can go to the Israeli public and say, you know, Iran is an existential threat. They're talking about our destruction. They deny the Holocaust and so on. So this resonates very well, I think, with the Israeli public.
And a lot of people, at least in the United States, are familiar with the kind of theater that goes on in Iran after Friday prayers in Tehran and the chanting of death to America and death to Israel. How much of that is substantive and how much of that is actually theater?
It's mostly actually, I think it's rhetoric or, I mean, there's part of it ideology, that's a separate thing, but I think it's a street, carnival. You could see this right during the hostage crisis when there were mass demonstrations outside the American embassy and the U.S. was described as Satan. And here, actually, it's interesting. The word Satan comes from Persian word shaitan. But in Iran, shaitan has two double meanings. One is the obvious meaning. The other meaning is actually a naughty, troublesome child. So if you have a five-year-old kid who's troublesome, you call them the little shaitan. And you find if the films of those demonstrations, if you look at them carefully, even in Nightline, often Carter was displayed as a puppet, but he's dressed up as a little kid. So he wasn't seen literally as a devil. He was seen as a troublesome child. So there's a lot of that, I think, in the public mood. But I think politically sophisticated people in Iran actually don't like those demonstrations anymore. It's kind of a relic from the past. But for the diehards, this is important because this is, for them, it's a way of reconfirming their adherence to Khomeini's basically doctrines. That's reformers, moderates, don't want these slogans, but those who are still Khomeinis, true Khomeinis, will continue the stuff about Israel. And again, Khomeini, he used it in rhetoric. Actually, when he sent trainers to Hezbollah, we know that he had given them instructions not to actually get into fighting with the Israelis. It was one thing to help Hezbollah. It was another thing to actually get into a physical confrontation with Israel. He didn't want that.
What about the treatment of minorities in Iran? There's a large Kurdish minority. There are Arabs, there are Armenians, Jews, and the beleaguered Baha'i sect.
You have to separate the different minorities. The ones who are really, have suffered, persecuted, the Baha'is, because they're seen as heretics from Shiism. And they were actually the largest community, so they suffered most, and much of the immigration out of Iran have been as the Baha'i community. With the Christian minorities and Jewish, there hasn't been basically that type of persecution or even discrimination. They've preserved their religious rights that are already in the Constitution. So in terms of the Christians, Jews, they have their synagogues, their civil law is under religious law, not under Islamic law. With the Sunnis, which is basically among the Baluchis, some Arabs, some Turkmans, some Kurds, not all Kurds, there is a problem because although officially everyone is equal, is clearly the constitution is a Shi'i constitution, and technically a Sunni can't become a president or supreme leader or so on. But in those areas also you do have local elections, so Sunnis do participate in grassroots elections or parliamentary elections. You can say formally, there is a problem about Sunni minority within Shiism, but they don't. The state doesn't recognize that because they say the argument is well, all Muslims are Muslims.
And the minorities have representation in parliament. I remember when I was in Iran, hearing about an Armenian member of parliament.
Yeah. Yes, actually, the Armenians have two representatives. The Assyrians have one. The Jews have one. Of course, the Baha'is are not accepted as a minority. They don't have it. So, in fact, actually, they get bigger representative than their numbers would warrant. But as a way of preserving or reassuring the minorities is to say you can always have candidates. And actually, in those elections, often it's pretty free elections. There's no very little government involvement in those elections.
What about the media in Iran? Can any of it be critical of the government?
It depends on the time. I mean, at periods, you find a lot of opening up. You get a lot of criticism, the reformist press. During the Khatami period, there was massive newspapers, journals, very critical and so on. There was the clampdown. Under Rouhani, there was slight opening up. But it's always very restricted what you could say. And so, but it's not complete, state controlled. So there are some newspapers reflect the reformist or moderate line, some conservative line. So it's not all in one step. And close reading shows that there's often, where the differences are.
Are there any examples? For example, in the old Soviet Union, there was Samizdat, underground press.
It's things circulate. I mean, the sum is that here is actually more insidious because there's a huge industry abroad of through internet, and it's suspect the my suspicion is it's huge amount of Saudi money. So there's a lot of films, videos, documentaries made in England very professionally. So it's a lot of expensive documentaries. And the idea basically is to undermine the Islamic Republic by creating this idea of nostalgia that everything was so good under the old regime. The Shah was such a nice guy, there was so much reform, modernization, and this was all destroyed by the Islamic Republic. And this very massive, actually, propaganda has direct effect because people in Iran, even if the local press is controlled, so many people have direct access to internet, to you know things that come out from Los Angeles, from London. It's the people have direct access to all this stuff. And books that are published in America, let's say, laudatory books on the Shah, are quickly translated in Iran and circulated in Iran.
I've heard that outside of Israel, that Iran is the country where the United States is the most popular. And culturally, that seems to be accurate. I remember on my couple of trips in the last decade to Iran, seeing lots of Hollywood videos and books and magazines available from the U.S.
Yeah, I think there's always some confusion between Iranians' approach to American culture, American citizens, and their attitude to the American government. So when it comes to the government, the U.S. policy, there's deep suspicion. But when it comes to person or American culture, I think the average, especially someone who's educated, they're quite open to American culture. And Americans who visit Iran, they're surprised how friendly people are because they don't associate American individual with the American state. In some ways, the Iranians are very sophisticated about that. And their suspicions or anger is really focused on American policy. So often, it's not just American, Western culture. People like basically Western music, pop music, Western clothes. These are all, I think, for Iranians quite acceptable. What's not acceptable is a Western domination of the state.
The National Security Advisor John Bolton has called for regime change in Iran. He made these comments addressing a group called the Mujahideen-e-Khalq. Often you see the acronym M-E-K. They've been described as a cult.
They use the term MEK actually to camouflage the Mujahideen Islam because the true background of the Mujahideen came out from the Islamic movement. And it was, in fact, a genuine radical movement against the Shah. But after the revolution, it became a personality cult, very much around one person, Rajavi, who had been in prison under the Shah. He converted the whole organization as his personal vehicle. And since then, it's become really no longer a political organization. I would call it as early a cult, a religious, not even religious, but a personality cult. So to become remain a member of the Mujahideen, you really have to see the leader as the imam, i.e. infallible person who represents God on earth until the return of the Messiah, the eventual imam to come eventually at the end of history. So the group is very small, but it's well-funded. Probably by the Saudis. So they can actually fund people like Bolton, Gingrich, Giuliani, number of people prominent in this administration. And what is surprising is these prominent Americans are willing to actually listen and abide by the Mujahideen notion of what Iran is like. So they talk about that by next year the Islamic Republic will be gone, implying that the Mujahideen would be then rulers of Iran, which fits fine with Iran, the Islamic Republic, because they can tell their American, their Iranian public, if you don't like us, look at who's there. Americans want to impose on you. And the vast majority of Iranians would actually prefer the Islamic Republic to the Mujahideen.
The Iran deal, known as the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the five permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany, was regarded as a major diplomatic breakthrough, and by all accounts, particularly coming from the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, Iran was in full compliance. The Director General of the IAEA in Vienna, Yukiya Amano, said that Iran, before the U.S. pullout, was subject to the world's most robust verification regime. Now, after the Trump regime pulled out in May of 2018, wasn't that a boon to the factions in Iran who say you can't trust the Americans? They keep moving the goalposts. You make an agreement, they go against it. Didn't it help enforce that particular view that they hold?
Yeah, actually, when negotiations were going on, the diehards in Iran were saying, you can't trust America. And actually, they were saying, implicitly saying, we should continue with the nuclear program. They didn't say we wanted a nuclear bomb, but they wanted to have the capability of having a nuclear bomb if necessary. So they were not willing, they were not supportive of the deal. It was the moderates who argued that we really don't need this program. We can keep the infrastructure, but give assurances to, actually wasn't the United States, UN, that we're not going to build a bomb. When the US withdrew, this actually adds fuel to the diehards to say, look, we told you so, you can't be trusted. And I'm sure what they're saying in privately is, let's continue with the program. Fortunately, I think the moderates, Rouhani, Zarif, the foreign minister, they still have the support of the leader that they should continue with the agreement, even with the U.S. withdrawing. Why? Because they say, well, the agreement isn't just with the United States, it's with the UN, or to be more precise, the 5+1, i.e. the five UN permanent members plus Germany. So they're the crucial countries that we should continue with that, because as long as we continue with their support, that means they are obliged to give us help. So with the sanctions, they should be morally obliged to break the sanctions and give us support. So then the problem will come if the Europeans, and the Russians and the Chinese actually buckle under the sanctions and stop buying oil and have no trade, which is what Bolton wants. If they buckle there, I don't think they will buckle, but if they buckle there, then the diehards have the upper hand. They say, what reason do we have to abide by this? Let's go full speed, not just enrich, but clearly enrich with the intention of making a bomb. When they get to that stage, of course, then Israel is going to bomb. But Israel, I don't think, has the capability of solving the problem. That will drag in United States to be able to deal with it. Because then at that point, it would be clear that for the diehards, the only way of survival is to build a bomb.
What will need to happen for rapprochement between the United States and Iran?
End of Trump. Hopefully, end of this term. But that's a big if.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, David. Thank you.
You were just listening to an interview with Ervant Abrahamyan on the U.S. and Iran, 4 decades of hostility. I talked with him at the University of Denver on April 24, 2019. Ervant Abrahamyan is Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Iranian and Middle Eastern History and Politics at the City University of New York. He's the author of The Coup, 1953, the CIA, and the Roots of Modern U.S.-Iranian Relations. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization Rise Up. We are in our 33rd year and are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Bill McKibben, Lawrence Wilkerson, Dar Jamail, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Michael Yates. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Ervant Abrahamyan on the U.S. and Iran, 4 decades of hostility, and his book, The Coup, 1953, the CIA and the Roots of Modern U.S.-Iranian Relations, just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Nader Hashemi. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.